Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. And welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm Jadim Sulongkumar, the host of this channel, and today I'm here with Yeli Wouters to talk about his book, In the Shadow of Naga Insurgency, Tribes, States, and Violence in Northeast India, published by Oxford University Press. So, Wouters, this book has been really enriching to me in a sense that, you know, when I read this book, I think it was... The thing was such that this is not only ethnographically rich, right? But then certain theoretical, things are also mentioned here. So there is a theoretical lens to this research. So I think that was something which I've always been long to look at for any Naga research or any work on Naga research. And I think this is a book or this is a work that has done really justice to that area. So before coming to this book, tell me something about yourself.
All right. First of all, thank you for having me here today. I'm an anthropologist, and I studied at the University of Oxford for my MPhil, and after that I joined Northeastern Hill University in Shillong, where I did my PhD. And my PhD was on the Naga. It was on insurgency, but indirectly through the kind of social carryovers and consequences of living in the shadows of insurgency, as I titled the book later. Currently, I lecture at Royal Thimphu College, and I'm based in Bhutan for the past, I think, 7 years or so. And prior to that, I taught at Sikkim University for about 3 years and was a visiting faculty at the Eberhard Karls University of Tübingen in Germany.
Okay, I think that's really great. You know, with any book, I think there's a story behind any research or coming up with any book as such. And I'm sure there's a story behind coming together of this, your research work and the coming together of this very book. So, I mean, what led you to write this book and also specifically something on insurgency and something on political life of the Nagas? I mean, what led you to this area of research and this work? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the selection of a research area is always contingent on many factors, both personal interest as well as perhaps social networks that may guide you towards a certain area or towards a certain theme. As well as, of course, a certain academic lacuna, a certain academic gap that needs to be filled. So what I found in the context of the Naga is that there is a great deal of scholarship that offers a panoramic overview of the Indo-Naga conflict, which is the oldest conflict, the oldest political military conflict in South Asia. But what we did not have, despite years and years of conflict and violence, was an ethnographic study of the Indo-Naga conflict. So what I tried was to provide an ethnographic underview, not of insurgency and counterinsurgency approach head-on, but by focusing on the kind of social carryovers and consequences of living in an area that has been under the spell of violence and conflict for many decades. So I think what informed my book was ethnography. I carried out about 2 years of ethnography in Nagaland. Most of it was among the Chakasang, which is located in so-called Western Nagaland, and about an eight months or so in Eastern Nagaland among the Chang, which was formerly an excluded area in the sense that it was not colonized. Right, so part of the fieldwork was in an area that had a colonial history. Another part of my research was in an area that did not have a colonial history, and this history of post-colonial existence and non-post-coloniality continue to imbricate in the present day. So I think, to cut this short, I think amid the literature that existed on the Indo-Naga political conflict, the ethnographic angle was not very pronounced, right? And my research was trying to provide that dimension to our broader understanding of conflict and insurgency.
Mm, yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I've seen that you did your PhD from NEHU, right? Northeastern Hill University, the university that I'm currently doing my PhD now. So what really brought you to Northeastern Hill University from the previous university that you were in? Yeah.
All right. Shifting to Northeastern Hill University was really a choice for a supervisor, right? I wanted to work under Professor T.B. Suba, who I'm sure you know very closely. Right? And I also felt that doing a PhD from a university within the wider region would give me more knowledge, more insight, as well as better access to the field. And I think over the years of carrying out my PhD, I've learned as much from my friends, from fellow PhD scholars, right? Through the informal chats on a daily basis, to sharing tea, sharing dinner. And so it was a continuous process of learning. So I think it was more it was less detached, right? It was very much I found it to have additional value to be in the region, to be in the larger region of where I was carrying out my fieldwork. And of course, being in Northeast India also gave me access to a lot of books and a lot of documents that are very important, but that are not really circulated outside of the region, right? Northeastern Hill University, the library, has a good Northeast India section, right? And many of those sources are almost impossible to access when you're not actually in the region.
Well, that's really interesting. And coming to the people, right, to groups of people, you see, when you go and talk and then live with a group of people, then yeah, somehow in certain instances as anthropologists, your perception also changes. So what was your perception of the Nagas before entering into the field or entering into Nagaland and you know, interacting with the people? I'm sure prior to going to Nagaland, you had experience or you had met Nagas and you know you had extensively talked to many people. So what were your perception about the Nagas before entering the field as such?
Ooh, that's quite a difficult question, and I had Naga friends long before I actually went to Nagaland. In 2007-2008, I was an exchange student at the Northeastern Hill University prior to going to Oxford, and at that point of time, my roommate was a Naga, right? And over the years, and many of my classmates were from Nagaland or from Naga areas outside of Nagaland, so I had a lot of Naga friends actually before I even set foot for the very first time in Nagaland. Living in a Naga village, I mean, as an anthropologist, you are changed in the field. You become a different person. It's such a valuable, enriching experience that allows you not only to study the community you're working with, but it also allows you to reflect on your own upbringing. It allows you to reflect on your own values and your own kind of way of understanding society and life itself. So I can only be very grateful to have had this experience, and I'm greatly thankful to the people I lived with, right? In both the villages I lived with an extended family, and they gracefully and very warmly invited me into their homes, and they I they are a part of me in the sense that I've learned so much from them, and I think they have changed me. I will not find it very easy to pinpoint how exactly they may have changed me, but I'm sure that they have, and definitely for the better.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I mean, the best thing of being an anthropologist is having that kind of experience, right? So that's really interesting to me. Yeah. So, you know, trying to set up the foundation in going into this book, you know, what were some of the theoretical lenses that you took up, or, you know, what are some of the people, works that have influenced you theoretically, right, in trying to understand or in trying to analyze the data that you have gathered? What were some of the theoretical lenses or the people's work that have influenced this work, actually? Yeah.
Okay. As I mentioned, I think scholarship on the Naga, especially in relation to insurgency, has long been kind of dominated by political science kind of top-down analysis that would look at certain historical events, that would look at certain petitions that were submitted or certain treaties that were signed and later failed. But this is quite a narrow view of insurgency. So what I wanted to do was to look at the shadows of insurgency. So to kind of acknowledge that among the Naga, that Naga insurgency has in fact long flooded the banks of political conflict. It washes in a way through all fields of social life. And therefore, I think the theoretical angle that I took on was to approach Naga insurgency as a complex, as an insurgency complex. So approaching Naga insurgency as a complex, right, that allows you to move beyond armed conflict in a strict or narrow sense. Instead, it recognizes how Naga's historical and embodied experiences, in a way, of resistance and state aggression, violence and political volatility, struggle and suffering, how all of those link together, and how these produce long-term mentalities and prejudices, how they shape social norms, how they shape moral evaluations, especially in relation to the state, in relation to corruption, and how they also shape local struggles and magnify interpersonal and intertribal relations. Right? Within the Naga fold, of course, you would know this very well, there are countless units of village, of clan, of tribe, right, of range, and all of them kind of mix and mingle, conflict and come together in expected, but also in unexpected ways. Right? So what emerges from this is not a complete transformation of social life, right? Because there are clear continuities between Naga traditions and the present, but a situation in which social relationships, moral reasoning, political sociality, as well as contemporary aspirations and culture, culturally scripted life projects, they're all kind of variously entangled in and complicated by the past and present of Naga insurgency. So in terms of theoretical influence, I admire the work of Alpha Shah, who I think has been able to achieve a lot of, to bring in a lot of kind of nuance and ethnographic underviews in relation to the Maoist insurgency in central India. And she was able to cut through the kind of simplistic dichotomies that supposedly exist between state and non-state actors. And she showed how in reality there are so many layers of knowledge, there are so many different kind of stakeholders who all intersect with one another in complex ways. So I would say that Alpha Shah has kind of theoretically, in terms of approach, has put me into the right direction. There are others, of course, but within the context of India, I would like to highlight the work of Alpha Shah.
Well, that's really good. So trying to unpack the complexity of the Naga society in terms of the political conflict and the political, you know, nuances that are there, let's go straight into with the book. And the heart of the book starts with the first chapter in the heart of the book is clan, village, tribe, and Naga nation. So what really are you trying to point out in this chapter? And, you know, what is the central take of this very chapter? Yeah.
Okay. A simplistic view holds that the Naga are an homogeneous kind of community that are confronting the Indian state, right? That the Naga are an imagined community in the sense of Benedict Anderson, right? Now, on the ground, we see that the Naga is in a way a multi-scalar community. you have all these different levels who are all equally important, right? You have the clan, or you have the kel, kel meaning village ward, usually more of a territorial notion. You have the village, you have the tribe, and you have the Naga nation. And all of these, in a way, are autonomous units. All of them can variously decide to involve or not involve in certain decisions. They can decide to support or not support the Naga struggle. They can, as we see very often, we see them coming together for certain political or economic purposes, and other times they are disassociating themselves. Right. So what I try to do in this chapter was to offer an ethnographic view of local process of identity and identification, and in the process go beyond the kind of simplistic notions of Nagas. So I was trying to highlight the social binds as well as divides that emerge from what I think are the structuring, foundational, and effective realities within the Naga fold, which is clan, village, and tribe. So I'm trying to theorize and understand the Naga not as a single ethnic rubric, but as a kind of a tribal confederacy in which connected yet self-directed tribes, but also smaller units, continuously fissure and fuse. And I think this allows us for this allows a more kind of complex understanding of the internal politics of within the Naga nation as well.
Yeah, that's really true. In a sense, in a society, understanding the dichotomies from the context itself is something which is not only enriching, but also at the same time, it brings out the kind of the quality of the research in a sense of how do we understand this complexity from their own terms, and then, you know, try to, you know, rectify and try to implore certain rather than trying to implore certain theoretical instances. So I think that is something quite interesting that you have really brought out in this chapter. So coming to the next chapter, that is titled as Ceasefire as Conflict, Fraction, Texas, and National Workers. So what is the thesis of this very chapter, and, you know, what are you hinting at from this chapter? Yeah.
I think here the main argument is actually fairly straightforward, and that is that we need to have a different, more complex understanding of what a ceasefire is. The Naga and the Naga are supposedly in a ceasefire since 1997. Now, what does the ceasefire actually mean on the ground? Right now, theoretically, a ceasefire kind of connotes the cessation of hostilities, its political stasis, political status quo, reconciliation, and of course, peace talk. But on the ground, right, the Indo-Naga ceasefire manifests itself as a much more complex and, I think, contentious social reality. And it's a social reality that sees the continuation of conflict by other forms and means. Right? Factionalism has become very pronounced after the ceasefire. Right? There was an internal kind of intertribal struggle for domination, for political legitimacy, as well as for kind of the right to tax, right, and the right to represent. So I think the main point here really is that we should change our understanding of what a ceasefire actually is. Ceasefire is also part of a conflict, but it is violence, conflict by other means. And what we also see in the during the time of ceasefire is that the boundaries between state and national workers as the kind of the way Naga caders and underground caders are often called locally, right? These become much more complex. It is quite kind of theoretically tempting to see the state and non-state as two distinct entities that mutually reject each other's existence. But in reality, there are so many kind of overlappings and crisscrossings between them, right? You have many Naga families where some people join the government and other people join the underground, and they come together for dinner, right? So it would be very artificial to kind of not recognize that insurgency actually and counterinsurgency are actually overlaid by very dense social and political networks that does not really allow one to separate the two. There's also, of course, a darker angle to it. A darker angle to it is all this mutually beneficial relations that exist between people on both sides. And they may have clear stakes in the continuation of insurgency. And this is particularly pronounced, I think, in relation to state funds and development funds.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's really quite an interesting, kind of decluttering of all of the surface notions of what the political struggle is all about and what ceasefire is all about, and trying to really look at it from the very ground level itself. And I think that these categories that you have mentioned in the second and the third chapter is something which was very helpful for even for the scholars to come also, actually, so that they learn these categories and try to understand, you know, the complexities that are there, and then, you know, they try to maneuver through this complexity. So coming to the next chapter, I think the next chapter is titled as Seeing the State, Violence, Seduction, and Neo-Tribal Developmentalism. So what is the argument? What are your arguments in this book, in this chapter, I mean? Yeah.
Now, this chapter asks, how do Naga see the state, right? And we can broadly separate into, conceptual at least, into two phases. The first phase was prior to the ceasefire, in which the state was primarily associated with violence. Then after the ceasefire, but also before, but it would be artificial to just bifurcate that very neatly, the state became associated as a dispenser of very generous kind of development funds. For many years, and I think this is a crucial kind of question that we have to engage, right? Nagaland received the highest per capita development funds anywhere in India. At the same time, development indexes show that Nagaland is not doing very poorly. They are often ranked at the middle, and for some indicators, they're even ranked towards the top, for instance, literacy, right? So here the question that emerges is that the reason that Nagaland received so much development attention cannot be because they are the poorest part of India. They are not, right? So this means that development funds must have another purpose. And the purpose is, in my reasoning, is the co-optation of Naga insurgency. It is in a way to kind of procure Naga's loyalty or Naga's acceptance of their Indian present and future. So when we are trying to see how Naga villages see the state, right, my argument would be that the history of the Naga present, right, is fundamentally shaped by a deeply embodied past of state violence, as well as a certain governmental ambiguity, right? So when we speak to villages, we learn that narratives of state repression, of past violence, continue to be kind of a key arena through which the Indian state is represented, imagined, and understood. Right? The state, especially for the elder generations, is almost a synonym for violence. Right? So Naga historical experiences of the state are in that way very contested, but they're also very multifarious. Right? Much changed with the contested creation of Nagaland state in 1963, which was an envisaged, but of course a failed political compromise to the demand for Naga independence. Right? But after this, for the very first time, the post-colonial state was no longer essentialized as an external entity, like best resisted, but it also became a localized apparatus, right, which was with Nagas at the helm, right? And at least formally, they projected the welfare of Nagas as its rationale, right? So after that, what we witness is that increasingly, villages came to stake claims on Nagaland state, and saw its officers and its officers as a lucrative but also morally ambivalent source, right? Now, these expectations were significantly nourished by the post-statehood influx of center-directed largesse, right? In the way we just discussed. So this state largesse is, in my reasoning, is part of a politically driven policy, right? Not a policy that is in response to poverty, but a politically driven policy, what I've called seduction, right? To which the center attempts to deeply penetrate the Naga Highlands and to tie local livelihoods to existing state structures and the political status quo. And in this, if this indeed was the objective, then the Indian state has been fairly successful, because a large number of Nagas, the majority of Nagas today, directly or indirectly, depend on the state for their sustenance.
Yeah, quite interesting. So we have the chapter, we have seen the very dichotomies of the social life of the Nagas. And then secondly, we have seen the complexity of understanding ceasefire. Then now, I mean, we have heard about the very complexity of even understanding state itself in Nagaland. Now, the next chapter is titled as Corruption and the Moral Economy of State Resources. So tell me the basic argument in this chapter.
Yeah. So chapter 5 is very much an extension of chapter 4. We often hear about corruption in relation to Nagland, right? It's very ubiquitous in the public discourse. And Nagland's often, I mean, a lot of Naga writers would also write about this in various way, about the crisis of corruption that is supposed to exist in Nagland. Now here, my argument is that we have to understand the nature of corruption a little differently. As an opening example, right? Nobody would kind of, at least not people are reluctant to condemn people who take money from the state that does not belong to them. But they would criticize if that person would not be sharing that those state funds with his kid and kin and other members of his social network. So my argument here is that we need to move beyond accusatory tone of corruption and explore the moral reasoning and perspectives villagers adopt in their dealings with the state and its development resources. And in the way in which to look at how they define corruption, when is it right according to them, when it is wrong, when is it justifiable, when it is not justifiable, right? So my view here, based on ethnography, is that there exists a distinct and specific relationship between kind of Naga's historical experiences of state violence and understandings of the post-colonial state. Most Nagas are perfectly aware that the amount of state funds that they are receiving is disproportionate. And they're also perfectly aware that they are receiving this for political reasons, right? Now, this has this kind of duality of state violence as well as state largess has impinged on local subjectivities, moral evaluations, and contested loyalties. Right? And I think in the upshot, what we see is the local emergence of a particular social and moral field in which corrupt practices must be situated. Right? Now, this chapter has been kind of read by some and critiqued by some for justifying corruption. That was not my intention. Right? My intention was not to say that corruption is something that is to be appreciated. Right? But my argument here was that the kind of accusatory tone of corruption or the language of the crisis of corruption, a sea of corruption, all of those, that kind of language, that does not really bring out the complexities that exist. That if we want to understand the nature of corruption, what corruption is and what corruption is not, we have to answer that ethnographically, right? And we can do so by studying the ways villagers interact with the state, the way the village development board operates, and the kind of moral and ethical discourses villagers adopt. So I think this was what I tried to do in this chapter.
Yeah, and interestingly, in a sense that it's like the while talking about money and corruption and all, it's also people label certain forms of corruption as corruption and certain forms of corruption as not corrupt in the sense of, I know, where they are getting their money or resources from. So, for example, if a church receives money from a politician, right, and if the politician is, in a sense, is not using money in a proper way, but still the church is receiving money, then in a certain way, the church who is receiving the money will not be seen as a corrupt body, right? In that sense, even though they might be receiving money which might not be from a proper channel or something like that. So, I mean, do you have any take on this one? Anything to say on this one?
I mean, in my book, I've also written, I think, on a case study in which state officers are using a part of the budget they have access to fund church activities. And what is happening here is that money is being transferred from a lower order entity, which is the state, I'm talking in terms of morality, in terms of how people perceive it, to a higher order entity, which is the church, right? So I think this is often quite self-justified in that way, right? So the state is used, some would say abused, right, to irrigate an entity that is much more closest to most Nagas, at least spiritually, morally, which is the church, right? So I think here again, to simply call this corruption, right, would not do justice to the kind of moral reasoning and complexities and nuances that kind of underwrit these flows.
Yes, yeah. And that opens up a more broader way of trying to understand corruption in itself. And I think this chapter is something which really opens up to that one. So moving on to the next chapter is titled as The State as Your Source, The Quest for Freunde Nagaland. So your argument in this chapter.
Yeah. Now, the state as a resource also refers to the kind of mutual beneficial links that everyone knows exist and which are ethnographically, you can document them ethnographically between underground cadres and state officers. And when we talk about taxes, when we talk about cuts that are being made, we know that state resources are to a very large extent the oxygen supply of most factions, right? So that is the idea of the state as a resource at one level. At the other level, I'm using the state as a resource in relation to the demand for Frontje Nagaland. Now, Frontje Nagaland calls for the bifurcation of Nagaland state into two independent, states within the Indian Union. And the demand for Frontje Nagaland is first and foremost a demand for access to the state and as well as control over state resources. Now, there is an important historical angle here, obviously, right? The six communities that demand Frontje Nagaland, they were left out or they were not colonized. So they have a non-post-colonial history at the moment, right? The so-called Western Nagas were colonized, right? And their grievance is that with colonization also came certain power for the Nagas, even though it was a kind of restricted and oppressed power, as well as access to missionaries who brought education, and all of which allowed so-called Western Nagas to move up. And when state structures, when Nagaland state was first kind of enacted, they were able to get most of the jobs. And then we go back to chapter 2, in which it is argued that most state resources and development projects are channeled through social networks, right? The argument or the grievance that is being articulated is that so-called Western Nagans were appropriating and redistributing development resources that are meant for the state as a whole to their own clans, villages, and tribes, leaving Eastern Nagas underdeveloped. I mean, there are a lot of counter-narratives here. There are a lot of more problems here. But this is the kind of popular notion that is irrigating the demand for Frontje Nagaland. Now, I think the way to see this, right, is that the creation of Nagaland state, even though it was seen as a political solution by some at that point of time, right, when we look at that in hindsight over the past 50 years, we see that it produced new constellations of power, Western against Eastern Nagas. This was not something that was used before Nagaland state was brought into existence. It's also created new fault lines and new axes of differentiation, including so-called backward and forward tribes, right? These are all kind of state categories that have become politically very sensitive. But the argument here is that the state is seen foremost as a resource, and that the six Eastern Naga tribes today, what they experience is a dominating and exploitative influence of Western Naga tribes, whom they see as advanced, and they accuse them of preventing Eastern Nagas from receiving their kind of development dues. Now, even when we speak with those in support of Frontje Nagaland, interestingly, they would not see this as contravening the rationale of the Naga movement. They would say that this would be a temporary kind of intervention which is needed for Eastern Nagas to come up par, so that later on they can again jointly join a unified kind of Naga limb. So here again we see how political narratives, how understandings of the Naga future or the Naga political movement has so many different domains. It exists at so many different levels. And Frontje Nagaland is just another level in that wider discourse.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting take on the very idea of the Frontje Nagaland. Yeah, so coming to the last chapter, that is Performing Democracy in Nagaland. Your argument in this book, yeah.
Yeah. This is part of my kind of broader work on democracy or kind of vernacular democracy. And if you want to put it very kind of in a one-liner, the argument would be that Nagalands refuse to adjust themselves to democracy in elections, but adjust the democracy in elections to themselves. So on the one hand, I think there are two kind of broad narratives in this chapter. One narrative is that that the Naga underground, even though they formally reject elections as Indian elections in Bolsonaro's soil, in reality, they cultivate all sorts of relations with politicians, with parties, right? And it is impossible, ethnographically at least, conceptually you can, but ethnographically you cannot separate underground politics and so-called overground politics. So this is one part of the discourse. What I basically ask in this chapter is, what do ordinary Naga men and women make of the modern democracy they have to engage with? And what we see is that democracy has become yet another avenue for Naga clans and villages and tribes to walk through their differences, to settle pre-existing conflicts, right? To exert themselves politically. So usually, in most cases, right, political talk is not about pamphlets. It's not about party politics. It's not about a certain kind of political ideology. The political ideology is social relations, right? In which clans compete over dominance and property, in which villages contest one another, and in which tribes also vie for power. And there are all these kind of local social alliances that will determine the election outcome.
Yeah. So since we are done, we are done with the chapters, and there is an epilogue which is titled as "A Life Beyond the Shadow of Naga Insurgency." And I insurgency. And I presume that you are giving some of the your views here, and also at the same time trying to look at it from look at the Naga situation from a broader lens, and also at the same time from a very positive lens. So, what is your take here in the epilogue, and what are you trying to say here? Yeah,
what I'm trying to say, and what I'm perhaps criticizing, is an excessive attention that is being paid to the peace negotiations and to a formal settlement. So the discourse or the understanding seems to be that the moment a particular document is signed, that the Indo-Naga conflict ends the next minute, right? But this will not be the case, because what the chapters together show, right, is that it is the shadows of insurgency, the shadows of insurgency in sense of the inter-clan and inter-tribal conflicts and misunderstandings that have emerged, the development kind of failures, the corruption, I mean, the kind of complexity of corruption, right? None of that will disappear when a peace deal is being signed. So if Naga society is to move from a so-called conflict to a post-conflict society, we have to take a much broader approach, an approach that goes beyond the need for a political agreement, right? So we can argue that a political agreement is a necessary condition. That is fairly uncontroversial to say, right? But it is definitely not a sufficient condition.
Yeah, and that's really great. This book is actually ethnographically very rich, but also at the same time gives a theoretical blend and a lens to it. And I think that is what makes this book really valuable in that sense. It brings out the complexity of the Naga society in that sense. So I think this book will be very helpful for scholars and for people who are working on Northeast India, on Nagas in India, and also anywhere else in the world who are working on different societies and the issues of, you know, insurgency and, you know, violence and democracy, and looking at the very complexity of tribe and state and the identity of the people ourselves. So I think that is something which really comes out from this book. And I think any listeners of this podcast would like to get their hand on this book and really would want to really try to explore this very book. And thank you, Wouters, for joining me for this very conversation. Thank you very much. And is there any new project or work that you are currently working on or looking forward to? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm currently quite interested in the entry of capitalist relations, newly capitalist relations, and how they interrelate with customs and chiefs, and how this is changing kind of the wider landscape. That is one strand of my current work. The other strand is in alignment with the environmental humanities, and this is to be more, and I think this is also very important in the NAGA context, to broaden our kind of to decentralize the anthropos and anthropology in a way, and to look more at human and non-human relations, including with the environment around us. So I think these are two kind of areas in which I'm slowly trying to delve. But I still have a couple of things to say about my fieldwork as well. I still have quite some data that I've not yet used. So in the next couple of years, that should come out in some way or another. What I might mention is that early next year, an edited volume is coming out. This is titled Vernacular Politics in Northeast India, Democracy, Ethnicity, and Indigeneity. And this will come out with OUP as well. And this has chapters from other states. We have a lot of great contributors from the region. And what we are trying to do in that book is to look at democracy and elections and politics more broadly, the way it has become vernacularized. So I think that is an exciting new what I think is an exciting new book that is coming out next year.
Yeah, very exciting projects and works, and also materials to come ahead. And I think I would request the listeners to also keep checking out all of these resources that are yet to come and your works, right? Thank you, Wouters. Thank you very much for joining me for this very conversation, and take care. Yeah.
Thank you.